Welcome to the WebMD podcast, where inspiration meets innovation. I am your host, Dr. Antonio Webb. Join us as we explore the journeys of remarkable individuals who have overcome challenges and who have achieved extraordinary success in and out of the medical field. Each episode, we delve into the experiences, insights, and wisdom that have shaped these inspiring lives. Whether you're in medicine or simply seeking motivation, this podcast is your go-to source for uplifting stories and powerful lessons. Let's embark on this journey together and be inspired by these incredible people who are making a difference in the world. This is the WebMD Podcast. All right, what's up, guys? Dr. Antonio Webb here. We're here with a very special guest today. We're going to hear his story about his kind of journey to becoming an orthopedic spine surgeon. His upbringing, his what led him to this path, and his current kind of situation today, where he's at, and kind of what his plans are for the future. So, this is a very uplifting, inspiring podcast today with Dr. Ejonway, and looking forward to it. Dr. Ejonway, what's up, man? Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, God is good. Thank you for having me.
All right, man. So we're going to jump right into it. Go ahead and introduce yourself to people that may not know who you are, and tell us what you do.
All right. I am Joel Ejonway. I'm an orthopedic spine surgeon in San Antonio, Texas. Basically, as an orthopedic trained surgeon, I can do everything in the body in regards to musculoskeletal system. But my main focus, my love, is the spine. So that's what I'm up to. That's what I'm doing here.
All right. So you're an orthopedic spine surgeon. Is this something that you always wanted to do? Did you always wanted to become a doctor? Because for me, ever since I was in high school, I wanted to become a doctor. And, it for everybody else, it's a little bit different in terms of when that first initial kind of interest kind of started. When did it start for you?
Man, so mine dates back kind of, I'll just probably say early high school. I went to a magnet medical high school in the Valley. So Rio Grande Valley, that's near, McAllen, Texas, near the border. I went to a high school in Mercedes called Med High. So basically it's geared towards, medical minded students in that respect. I am, I'm the youngest out of five individuals. My sisters who are older than me, obviously. And, they're kind of medically minded. My parents, Nigerian born, came here and they were basically letting me know, hey, whatever you want to do, you can do. And so as would happen, my older sister, who is internal medicine, she's practicing in Houston. She was like, hey, guys, medicine, this is fun. This is that. Kind of showed us snippets here and there. That's where that interest was sparked. But I would say probably my high school, senior year, I really figured out that, hey, medicine's for me.
Okay, so you're Nigerian.
I am Nigerian.
So what part of Nigeria are you from?
So I'm from Benin State, Edo State, actually. that is, we're not like the major tribe in that regard. People commonly, when they think of Nigerians, they think of like Igbo people or people Yoruba or, Lagos. But I'm from, Benin, Edo State. I wasn't born there. I was born in Nebraska, Lincoln, Nebraska. So, United States born. Yep. Go Cornhuskers. That being said, I'm not a Cornhusker fan. Texas is what I love through and through. But, so having Nigerian parents, that's a part of the journey.
Yeah. So we're going to jump right into it. I hear all these things online and people going back and forth about this rice between Nigerian and Ghanaian. Let's break it straight. Who has the best rice?
So I'm gonna lean in on this one. Nigerians and hear it in the base of my voice. Nigerians have the best jollof rice in history.
All right.
Present, past, and future. I'm gonna leave it at that. I'm gonna leave it at that.
All right. Yeah. I mean, that's something on my bucket list to try. But I take your word for it, man. I definitely hear people going back and forth about who has the best rice, but, you know, we're going to take your word for it. So growing up with Nigerian parents, how was that? Because I always, you know, hear people talking about, you know, they motivate you, they push you. Mm-hmm. You know, you come home with A minuses, they think that, you know, you got to get an A plus, and they push you to go even farther. How was that growing up with Nigerian parents?
So you have to take everything with a grain of salt. So Nigerian parents, they don't play. My dad, my mom were all about education. My mom did not play at all when it came to education, but more for not just for my success when it comes to business or, you know, having monetary gains. It's really just for education and knowledge, because her biggest thing was knowledge is power. Same thing with my dad, knowledge is power. So in that respect, you know, they understood that, hey, if you had a good understanding of everything around you, whether it's spiritual, whether it's, you know, is it medicine, is it engineering, whatever the case may be, as long as you have a good understanding of it, then you can turn that into your career. So that's why they didn't really push hard. You know, that the thought process is when it comes to people, when people think about like Nigerians or Asians, is that, you know, you have that either they want you to be a lawyer, they want you to be a doctor, they want you to be something high powered. That wasn't that malignant thought process my parents had. It was really just, you need to understand your life. You need to understand what it is like to live in different parts of the world. But you need to have a drive for knowledge. So, yeah, they would be on me. If I was, you know, because I wasn't always this, like, hard-driven, I need A's on everything. I mean, that kicked in, and that's a part of the journey. But when I would slack off, my parents would not, especially my mom, she was not playing any games. They would get me into shape quick.
Yeah, you definitely need some of that, kind of someone to kind of push you along. And, you know, when you're having some setbacks or just not have the motivation to kind of keep moving forward, it's always helpful to have, especially parents or siblings that are older than you, kind of push you along. You mentioned that your sister is a physician. How many sisters do you have that are physicians?
So I have four older sisters. The first one, internal medicine, she's a physician. The second one is an ENT, that's ears, nose, and throat. So she's a surgeon. Third one's a nurse. The fourth one, she's also in the medical field. You know, she's a clinical specialist for, you know, devices. So all throughout Texas. And they're a part of my journey too. So not only having my parents who'd push me, my mom who was very, you know, staunch in regards to making sure that I was, you know, proceeding down a good path, my sisters were, you know, also a good influence too.
Yeah. And what about your parents? Are they in the medical field as well?
My dad is a retired clinical dietetics professor. He was practicing in Edinburgh, Texas at the university. My mom, she, even though she's like has a heart for nutrition, she actually has her master's in business and education. So, and then also now she's a writer. So she does a lot of Christian books.
Yeah, good. And then being a part of a family that so many people are in the medical field, do you think that kind of shaped your path or desires to go down this path as well?
100%. Because, you know, so the whole thing about my family was that, you know, from a young age, we always knew that we had a calling, that God wanted us to do something. And that's kind of where things were shaped. And so when my sisters started looking into becoming physicians and whatnot, I guess you could say in totality thought, hey, how can we all fit into this, you know, this journey? How can we use this to help people? And medicine was that niche for all of us. We enjoyed it. We loved it. Seeing my older two sisters go down that, you know, med school pathway was very inspiring for me. What was great is that they went through a bunch of hurdles. And, you know, we'll get into this because, you know, how I met you when we talk about all that. But having that person in front of you to kind of help and, hey, watch out for that mind here, watch out for that mind here. And you also have to learn your own journey, what works for you. But that was very, very helpful along the pathway, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. It's always good to have someone that has been through the path already that can guide you and just kind of coach you along. I think that's extremely important, especially in the medical field. Can you talk about a little bit about where you went to college and then subsequently medical school and kind of that journey after being in Nebraska?
Okay. So the majority of stuff kind of started off, like I said, in the Valley. I went to high school at Med High. College, I went to University of Texas Pan American. That's in Edinburgh, Texas. 4 years there, pre-med, biology major, minored in chemistry. After that, you know, you take your You take your MCAT, you get your score, whatever the case may be, and then you go through the process of, you know, interviewing a bunch of different places. I actually first matched into a medical school in San Antonio.
Really?
But because my sisters went to UTMB, that's the University of Texas Medical Branch, and I mean, you know, that UTMB, that's where I went. I loved that place. So obviously I went through there, 4 years medical school, master orthopedics. Then I trained at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. That was a 5-year orthopedic residency, which was good within itself. And then I matched for a year in spine surgery at Texas Beck Institute. And so then I, after that, came back here and, you know, now practicing in the South Texas Spine Clinic.
Yeah, awesome. If you can describe medical school in one word, how would you describe it?
I wish I had two. For one, I would say challenging. The second one, I would say would be, if I had a second word, it would be fulfilling.
Fulfilling. Medical school is certainly a time where I would never forget. It was certainly challenging, but it's also a place where, you know, we meet lifelong friends and mentors, and it really starts our journey into the medical field. You know, everybody has a different experience in medical school. Did you find yourself at certain points in medical school struggling with the coursework and with the amount of work that was bestowed upon us?
So I think, you know, what you just said kind of played into, you know, the whole process. So what it is very challenging. You have to, you know, time management, you're getting thrown into all these different courses, these different subject matters. How do you deal with that and learn that while, you know, going through the rigors, right? So there were certain times where, you know, if a topic wasn't clicking, I had to spend extra time, wake up earlier to use ancillary information to, you know, grasp the concept. What was good is that, like you said, you develop friends there. I had a good group of individuals who, you know, some of them I'm still in contact with. We would spend late nights. I'm talking about after class. Let's say class in at 3 p.m. You go home. You go, you know, work life balance. You go to the gym, eat whatever. We head back to campus and we would stay there until 12 a.m. 1, whatever the case may be. Let's say if it's before a test. And you're just going through the content as much as you possibly can to get a good grasp of what's happening. So I think, and in the moment, it, you know, you'll have times where you enjoy it because, you know, there's those breaks where you're having banter, you're enjoying yourself. But there's still a little struggle there because, right, you stayed up late and then you have to wake up early in the morning to then go to class and pick up more information. So it's that cycle. But I'm not going to lie, a part of it was pretty enjoyable.
What was the most amount of hours you studied per day in medical school?
So I had a little schedule. Let's say I'd probably say the most, studying for step 10 hours,
10 hours in 1 day,
10 hours. That's the most. But it wasn't not just that 1 day. So let's say it was 10 hours when you're studying for your step. So step one is important. Step two is even, you know, it's big, but step one is very important. You know, you have a certain period of time where, you know, you're no more in classes. You're no more doing the, you know, subject group discussions. And it's just purely you have that free, that open day to get everything in order. So I wake up in the morning, study, take a short break, go to the gym, go back and study until, you know, I couldn't anymore and go to sleep. So maybe 10, 11 hours. Yeah,
that's a long time, especially to be sitting and looking through books and notes and things like that. You know, there's a lot of discussion, which it's probably not talked about enough, is kind of physician and also student suicide, depression, anxiety. All of these things kind of come out during medical school, where it's very rigorous, and where students, you're in college and you do really well, and most people that get to the medical school level, everyone's really smart and brilliant, but they find it challenging in medical school due to the sheer amount of information that's out there that you have to learn, and just how challenging and rigorous medical school is. And then some people just don't ask for help, or they're too afraid to ask for help. And this kind of leads to kind of suicide, physician burnout, stress, anxiety. Can you talk a little bit about that? And have you ever experienced that in any students or friends, classmates, and also maybe yourself? Can you talk about that?
So thank God for myself, I didn't go through, you know, the thoughts of suicide or anything of that nature. I would attribute all that to, you know, my relationship with God, because, you know, what was building at that time was not only my medical knowledge, but also my spiritual, my knowledge. And that was my foundation. That's what helped me through the late nights. That's what helped. Anytime you had turmoil, that's what I lean on. Right. But, you know, unfortunately, in my medical school class, no one died, you know, thank God for that. But there's a lot of talk about just that struggle, people dealing with intense depression, feeling overwhelmed. You know, I have close friends who we would have to come together in like a, you know, in a like a support group to assist somebody. And how can we as a group help this person who we know is struggling just mentally, dealing with the pressures of medical school? How can we support them, keeping them so that they don't fail the courses or they don't want to quit. So we don't, you know, so they don't feel like, hey, this is just too much. I need to leave everything I worked for. So we had to do that quite often. some people left just because the stress was too much. I think in my class, we maybe had like four or five individuals over the 4 years who decided, hey, medicine's not for me. And that's okay, because, you know, you have medical school, then you have residency, and that's even more of a grind. So yeah, it's very, very common when we're dealing with depression and anxiety and, you know, the fear of accomplishment and imposter syndrome, all that type of stuff in medical school for sure.
Definitely a problem that needs to be addressed and that is not spoke about too often. And that's hopefully this platform can raise some awareness surrounding those topics. What advice would you give to those students that may be listening, or even residents that are going through a tough time in medical school, residency, fellowship, or even pre-med, that are burnt out, depressed, they just don't see the light at the end of the tunnel? What advice would you give to them?
Foundation is key. Foundation is key. And when I'm talking about foundation, as in you have to have key things in your life that are going to support you when times get tough. So you want to build that up when times are good. So understand this. If you know you're about to enter into a season where it's tough, you want to make sure your foundation is solid to support you. So number one, if you believe in things of the spirit, if you know a Christian, that case, you need to work on that spiritual base. That spiritual base will support you. Like I said, for me, that's where I leaned on. That's where I got my understanding. That's where I got my strength. Then work-life balance is a real thing. That applies even before you have a job. It's not all about gathering that knowledge in school and whatever and, oh, I need to accomplish my goals. You need to understand that your body needs rest. You need to eat good food. You need to, all that is what's going to help support you while you're going through all of, you know, the turmoils of that process. Family is another key thing too, and relationships. So you need to make sure you have, you know, who amongst my friends or amongst my family can bring positivity and not just somebody who, you know, can take comfort in the pain that I'm going through. Like, oh, you know, misery loves company. I don't need somebody next to me who's like, oh yeah, no, that's tough and everything you're going through is a struggle. I'm surprised you're able to do it. I need somebody who's going to give me that motivational support. Like, hey, you know what? I'm not in this situation, but let me pour into your life. Ideally, they're pouring into your life, you know, things of the spirit, you know, things that can help you and help you with, you know, your first foundation, which is God there. And that was for me, but just, you know, positive affirmations. You got this. This is temporary. Think of the light at the end of the tunnel, that type of support. When you have all that down, at the end of the day, it is going to be you. And so you got to really focus in on, you know, the goal at hand and understand that everything in life is temporary. This is not a season that you remain in for the rest of your life. There's a reason why you chose it. In order to do this, you have to go through this path. So just reminding yourself, and then giving yourself grace. Not everybody's perfect. As a matter of fact, let me change that. There's nobody perfect. So you won't be that perfect person. Make sure that you understand failure can come, and it may not be failure that you're anticipating, but if it does come, you can get out of it. Just focus, you know, and then just think back. Last thing I'm going to say to that is what my mom always taught me is, especially when it comes to medicine or anything, is you may think about all the things you have to accomplish, but just do it in a stepwise progression. Make a list of everything you got to do, but disregard a lot of it from the beginning and just think, what's the next thing I need to do? Accomplish that? Great. Boom. Check mark. Done. Next thing. check mark, done. Before you know it, you'll start to notice, hey, I have a bunch of these check marks. I'm making these accomplishments. I'm progressing. It's baby steps. So, you know, keeping all that in focus is important.
Yeah, those are all great points. And, you know, as you mentioned, just having a strong foundation is essential, whether that's spiritual or just having a foundation where you can lean on family, friends for support. That's essentially that's crucial. That's critical to be able to make it along this journey and make it along this path. You know, I saw some statistics looking at physician suicide. I believe they said in 1 year, like an entire medical school class is lost to physician suicide. So it's definitely something that needs to be talked about, brought more awareness to the forefront, because this journey, it's definitely challenging. Just like putting yourself through a fight. You wouldn't go through a fight without equipping your body with the necessary tools. And that's spiritual, that's mental, that's physical. Mm-hmm. So going through this whole journey, the importance of nutrition, mental health, spiritual health, fitness is critical. Mm-hmm. And just like a lot of similarities in the medical field with spine surgery, and I always explain to patients that before we undergo this surgery, we got to make sure that you're physically able to make it through the surgery, you're mentally, that you don't have any untreated depression, anxiety, psychiatric disorders that are not treated that can impact your outcome, as well as mentally, physically, as well as spiritually. I mean, it's spine surgery is a big deal, and patients, if these things are not addressed beforehand, can have bad outcomes. So I think those things are really important. When did you decide upon orthopedics, and were there any other specialties that you were considering in medical school? For me, I didn't decide. I was a late bloomer. I decided my third year of medical school, kind of later in my third year. But when did you know you wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon?
Hey, you're talking to another late bloomer, man, for real. So third year as well for me. My sister was a resident, my second oldest, so Suzanne, was a ENT resident at UTMB, right, when I was a medical student. So she was like a fifth year. And earlier on, she would ask me, hey, what do you want to do? I'm not sure, but I'm in medicine, so I'm just keeping my head down, trying to focus. She was very good at, and my older sister too. My older sister, Mercy, was, you know, very, very, very helpful. They're both very helpful when it came to you know, choosing a field. How that process went was, they, since they already went through the process, one's a surgeon, one's you know, internal medicine, so they were both on the one on clinical, one on the surgical aspect. So they asked me, what do you want to do? Well, first question, how do you like rounding, in regards to rounding? Do you feel satisfied? Do you feel satisfied with the cerebral aspect of it? All those natures, you know, seeing the patient in, you know, clinic, all that stuff. I'm like, yeah, that's great. I love that. And then my sister Suzanne brought in the other aspect of it. Do you feel like, you know, if I'm looking back at you, you like to do things with your hands a lot. When you are on these surgical rotations, how do you feel about that? And I told her, hey, that's really fun. That's where I feel most alive, to be honest with you. So that kind of helped me glean towards the surgical route, right? So once that was done, she asked, what surgeon do you want to be? What kind of surgeon? I did not know. At that point in time, what was around my mindset was cardiology. Then that led to cardiothoracic surgery. So I was like, hey, cardiothoracic surgery, that's on point. That's where my mind's at, right? She one day, you know, being a fifth year ENT resident, she was very well known amongst the other specialties, and she had a good rapport with them. So one day she just took me from OR to OR in different specialty, went to a neurosurgery room. They're doing a cranny, and they allowed me to, you know, not scrub the case, but just walk up in and ask questions and see what was going on. And I realized, I was like, hey, this is kind of nice. It's not bad. Not for me though. So, I left. She took me to an ENT. Her attending at the time was doing a case, and they're operating very fine movements in the ear. I saw that, and in my mind, I was like, next, that's not for me either.
You know? You didn't want to just operate on the ear.
No, they do so much other stuff, yeah. You know, some critical things, but yeah. I was just like, this is, I love it, but it's just not it. That's just not it for me. Her friend, who is the orthopedic resident, he was like, he was, I remember seeing him in the hallway. And then, you know, like I said, my sister was real cool with everybody. He was like, hey, your brother, what are you guys doing? And she's like, oh, I'm taking around all the rooms so he can get a good feel of it. He was like, he looks like he's ortho. And he walks off. He walks off. And so so that was that day. So I kind of ruled out a few specialties, went to a bunch of different rooms, a few specialties I ruled out. Since I was thinking, okay, I didn't get to see the cardiothoracic surgery because they didn't have a case that day. I was on a rotation. They had a, we're in the ED. A guy fell. He had a previous, you know, they're working him up. He had a cardiac tamponade. So for what that basically means is that there's a sac that surrounds the heart, right? And he had a rupture or a bleed to a certain extent where that sac that surrounds the heart was filled with blood, and that was not going to allow him to, you know, for his heart to conduct as it needs to in regards to pump because that space was occupied. So a lot of the cardiothoracic surgeons who came down, they were just so hyped about this case because he had the scarring. So it wasn't, you know, he was still able to get some motion. It was just very complex at the time. They're like, you got to come see this. We're going to do this right now. It's quick, fast. Got into the room. It was very organized. You know, they had the bypass going. And I was in the back and thinking in my head, hey, this is what I want to do. When I got into the room, I was like, not at all. This is not what I want to do. It was very controlled, very, very smooth, but just wasn't it. So I ruled that out. I got into a rotation on orthopedics. So I was like, hey, this is one of the last things remaining. I got to work with a pediatric orthopedic surgeon. I had a resident who was one of, you know, resident and a medical student. They have like a little mentor while on that rotation. And then I also got to meet Ronald Lindsay, who is the chairman of orthopedics. I jumped in, and then Dr. Stevenson. Working with these people, they had the same nature I had. They were just chill. Went in, did their job. They were really cool in explaining things. Saw the surgeries, especially, you know, joint surgery.
Yep.
It's pretty bloody. It's, you know, big hammers, all that stuff. And I was like, hey, I'm home. I'm home now. So, yeah, then it was late third year. I just so happened to be doing musculoskeletal research because, you know, orthopedics is very competitive. And you need a lot of research for that. So, you know, God allowed things to just line up. By the time I found out as a late bloomer, my pathway was kind of, you know, things that I'm like, oh, I need research. I already had all that stuff. So it worked out for me to choose orthopedics in that way.
Yeah. And then there's some stats that are out there that says that less than 1.9% of orthopedic surgeons are African American. Did that influence your decision at all? And what are your thoughts about that? What are the issues at hand? And how can we address that alarming statistic that shows that less than 1.9% of orthopedic surgeons are African American?
Man, that is troubling. That's highly troubling. So, as I mentioned, that chairman, Ronald Lindsay, African American individual, right? And he was in charge of this big program. But that was the one thing that was also inspiring. This African-American man, this male African-American guy, when you go to the conference room, right, you have all of these other surgeons, you have all these residents and medical students. Tell me why it was the only other black person I saw in that room was him. So seeing somebody of my, you know, from the same background in regards to, you know, being African-American, be at the top of the totem pole was good to see, but it was also sad to see that, you know, there was nobody else down the line in that regard. So, and that still stands true. When I got into residency, there's one point in time where when you left, there's one point in time, I was the only, me and Jordy, who's my co-resident, we're the only two black people amongst other individuals out there. And my co-residents were great. And then, you know, the residents around me were great too, but still it's a problem when we know that under the skin, everybody is the same. You may have different pathologies, but everyone's the same. There should be no reason why we don't have the same amount of representation in orthopedics, in medicine in general, right? That's a problem because I think, you know, that lack of representation also kind of gives pause to people coming down the line to want to get into the field that we're in or even medicine in general. And when you see it, and you've seen it yourself, patients open up and open up when they see somebody like them who relates to them versus, you know, when it's not the same. So I think it's a problem. I think that's something we need to address. Unfortunately, you know, with all the initiatives are coming down the pipeline, some are forward and some are really faltering and trying to hold that change back. But yeah, it's a big issue, a huge issue.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. You know, we have a very homogenous workforce that is being taken, or that is essentially taking care of a very heterogeneous population of people. And I think patients need to be treated by providers that look like them, just because there's been multiple studies that show that their outcomes, their kind of willingness to participate in the treatment plan and adhere to the recommendations are better when the provider that looks like them. There's been multiple studies that look at, like, African Americans are less likely to receive knee replacements, hip replacements, heart transplants, kidney transplants, and the list goes on. So that's kind of a passion of mine, is just to encourage students to go into the field, especially those that are minority descent, as well as specifically African Americans, just because you know, those alarming statistics that show that less than 1.9% of orthopedic surgeons are African American. So it's a problem, needs to be addressed, and you know, that's what I'm passionate about. So you did your orthopedic surgery residency at UT Health San Antonio, and then you went off to the Texas Back Institute, the prestigious Texas Back Institute for fellowship. How was your time at TBI?
Man, I loved TBI. I love TBI through and through. TBI, you know, you have so TBI to me is the best of both worlds. It bridges that gap, right? So when it comes to the spine, you're managed either by an orthopedic spine surgeon or a neurosurgeon with the focus in the spine, or just a neurosurgeon who does both, right?
So who should a patient see? Orthopedic spine surgeon or a neurosurgeon? Which one should they see?
I mean, obviously they can see either one, but I, as an orthopedic spine surgeon, I'm just kidding. No, it's either one is fine. As long as they do spine. It also depends on what's the issue at hand.
Because I do have a lot of patients, they come in and they'll refer to me a lot as a neurosurgeon, but you know, they'll say, like, hey doc, should I go to a neurosurgeon for this pathology or for my condition? Should a patient choose orthopedic spine surgery versus a neurosurgeon? That's a big question that's out there.
Yeah.
Does it make a difference?
It does not make a difference. Let's say that if your pathology, let's say you have a tonsillar herniation, right, where you have your cerebellum is essentially, it's your cerebellum, which is at the base of your brain, is going down to your spinal canal, right? Something like that, where, you know, you have to open that up. Well, since it's in that in between, if that's your specific pathology, a neurosurgeon is more likely for you. But if it's anything dealing with the spine, the bony spine, ligaments, tumors, anything like that within the spine, it doesn't matter who you see. You're still a spine surgeon. As long as you know how to do it, that's the person you should see.
Yeah, I agree. When I get asked that question, orthopedic spine surgeon versus a neurosurgeon, we do exactly the same surgeries. We treat the same pathology that's in the cervical spine, thoracic spine, or lumbar spine, or even the pelvis. And we have similar in terms of training. There are a lot of neurosurgeons that do a fellowship in spine surgery once they complete their residency. And there's orthopedic spine surgeons that, you know, we have to do a spine fellowship. So in order which one to see, it comes down to who you're comfortable with. But just like you said, if it's something that involves the brain and needs to go to neurosurgery, for intradural, if there's pathology, a tumor that's inside of the spinal cord, there are some orthopedic spine surgeons that will address that. But for the vast majority of that goes to neurosurgery. But anything else, we receive very similar training. I think the plan is for the future for it to have a joint program where neurosurgeons and orthopedic surgeons are going to train together, and that's a spine surgery path. But
exactly.
Going back to your time at TBI, I agree. It was the best of both worlds, because we got trained by neurosurgeons as well as world leaders in spine surgery that are orthopedic surgeons. Is that kind of how you felt also?
100%. 100%. The meeting of the minds. What was good is that, you know, they all had their niche, but they all cared about training their fellows, and they didn't treat their fellows like, you know, indentured servants in that regard. You know, they treat you like a junior faculty, but their focus was on how could I surgically, clinically improve you, and within that period of time, give you everything we possibly can give you to make you the best surgeon. And I mean, from the program director, Dr. Geyer, all the way down, I mean, I can't speak any highly of that institution.
Sure. What was the craziest case that you saw in fellowship?
It was actually with Dr. Bellinger. So Dr. Bellinger is a deformity surgeon out there, and he likes to do medical mission trips. So we went to Ethiopia, and it was a short trip. At least on my side, I was there for like maybe 10 days or whatever the case may be. So you're doing significant, like you're doing, you know, vertebral column resections, all this major, major deformity cases. We had this individual who had ankylosing spine. So basically imagine, you know, you have your vertebral bodies and in between you have discs. Well, in this guy's case, you know, he just had bridging bone through and through with a massive deformity. So for him, you know, the deformity correction was amazing. Because, you know, we took an individual who was essentially with his body contorted to now being able to sit upright. And it was a lot of surgical intervention. It was a lot of, you know, it took a lot of time and effort. But I would probably say that would be the craziest case that I saw.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Ethiopia. And then, you know, a lot of the cases that we were doing out there were pretty significant. Dr. Bellinger, what he does out there for these individuals, I mean, life-changing is an understatement.
Excellent. So you completed your fellowship at TBI, and then you had to make this decision which kind of route to take, whether that's private practice, academic, or employed, or working for a hospital. Were you considering, given that you're in private practice now, were you considering the other practice kind of types, and why did you decide upon private practice?
So for me, what was great is that I had people ahead of me kind of, you know, teaching me and kind of guiding me that situation. So that's where you came in, right? So since I was talking to you way before, even, I mean, once I started residency, when I met you in the way beginning, we would talk about a lot of different things, right? Not just medicine, but the other aspects of it too. So I was actually learning from your experience, the ups and the downs, and then the nuances. You would tell me that type of stuff. So then I kind of geared my mindset of, hey, I'm looking at private, which, you know, you're in right now, employee, which was considered, and then academic. I realized, you know, autonomy is huge, right? Being able to be my own boss is huge. That goes to private. I realized I want to have my hand in every aspect of my practice so that somebody can't dictate how I have to do certain things with my patients, because when I have my patient, I consider them in totality. I don't want, if I feel like something's in their best interest, the only, you know, opinions that matter are the patient and mine. I don't want an outside external force to really dictate that. So, you know, that led me more towards that private aspect of it. And then when I compared it, and I had discussions with you, had discussions with my sisters, discussions with other individuals, you know, it was really, you know, the bullseye for me was private practice.
Got you. So you're in private practice. You've been in practice for coming up on a year now. Mm-hmm. What was the biggest purchase that you've made since becoming a spine surgeon in practice?
The biggest purchase?
I'd
probably say it would be my car.
Okay.
Yeah.
That Bentley outside?
Nah. No Bentley for me. No Bentley for me. No Bentley for me.
Yeah, no worries.
But it's I'm not a flashy guy in regards to it. So I don't drive a $100,000 car or anything like that. But for me, I came from the cars that I would use is like a Toyota Camry, and I love Toyota, so I'm gonna just put that out there. Toyota has been my workhorse ever since I started to drive. The car that I have now is like probably like a step and a half above a Toyota, but for me, it's a big purchase.
Yeah. So, what's been the biggest challenge since starting private practice? What have you found most difficult been in practice over the last year?
You know, so I actually enjoy the fact that, you know, as a resident, as a fellow, they're not fully your patient. You know, you kind of have to dictate. You have to go based off what the attending. I like the fact that now I'm at the top. I make the decisions. I love that aspect of it. But that's a transitional change, right? But that's also enjoyable because now I can apply everything and make the best decision, that shared decision making with the patient. It is when it comes to marketing and not, I don't want to say selling yourself, but putting that information out there. That's what's tough, especially for my personality. I'm more of an introvert with some extrovert tendencies. But in private practice, it's not like academic medicine or employee where, you know, you have all these big systems to, you know, to funnel patients. Or in academic, since you're salary based, right? For example, just using that example, even employee, you're salary based, right? But since your salary base, you know, you have these this infrastructure to kind of get these patients to you, right? If you're this, if you're the spine guy, well, the people within the that institution, you know, they're more inclined to refer to you because you are the spine guy within that institution. So that's when I have to lean on people like yourself. And so I, you know, my thought process is, and you know, I think it'd be good for the viewer to hear that or the listener to hear that is. My challenge is the marketing aspect of it, right? What would you recommend there in that aspect as a spine surgeon or just when you're coming out into practice and you're not, it's not, you know, spine, it's medicine in general, whatever. How would you approach that?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, just being in practice or even starting in residency, you have to build a brand for yourself. So, and I always tell people that, you know, when you're building a brand, you want to make it about yourself. You don't want to build a brand around a specific institution or a practice because you may no longer be there after a few years. The statistics show that 50% of people leave their first job within the first 2 years. So it's important to have a brand that is not only transferable, but something that you can market yourself. So meaning that my brand is Antonio Webb MD. And that's, you know, if I work for this practice here, or if I move to Colorado, or if I move to Hawaii and practice medicine, my whole brand is transferable. I can take all of that with me and go to the next practice. So you have to have a build a brand that's marketable, that's transferable, and also that you know that you can use to market yourself and your practice. So it's just getting yourself out there, being available, being nice, and that's easy to say. But there are some surgeons out there that can be completely malignant, and I just don't understand it. So if you just be nice, take good care of patients, do your job, you know. The outcomes will speak for themselves and patients will tell their family members about you and that family member will tell another family member and that's how you really build your practice. But to really build a practice, it takes anywhere between 3 to 5 years and me being in my fourth year in practice, I'm still building, but I can see the momentum kind of shifting now that I've been doing this for a few years. So that's what I would say about kind of marketing a practice.
Makes sense.
What's your favorite surgery to do in spine surgery?
Oh man. Right now it's ALIFs.
ALIFs?
ALIFs in the right indicated patient.
What's an ALIF?
So that's an anterior lumbar interbody fusion. So let's say an individual is coming into your office and they have significant leg pain, right? And, you know, you have to try conservative care, right? Because not the problem is, you know, not a lot of people understand this. You have to, not everything needs a knife. Surgery is not indicated for everybody. Conservative care, there's a reason why it's out there. It's not just to say I did conservative care. No, physical therapy helps significantly. Adjusting your activities helps significantly. You know, medication, certain medication, I don't want you addicted to, you know, narcotics or anything like that, but certain medication can be helpful. When an individual comes in and they've tried all those measures, injections, all that stuff, and they're unable to do their activities of daily living, and they have significant leg pain, weakness, etc., you know, that's when an ALIF can be, that anterior lumbar interbody fusion can be important because, for example, you have your spinal canal, but when those nerves, those roots exit your canal, they go through what we call foramen. And that foramen can be compressed if you have degenerative disc disease and, you know, you have a collapse, the foramen is top down, is, you know, small, the nerve's not able to exit. Well, one of the things we can do is go, you know, with the use of a vascular surgeon, they'll go in through the front, what we call retroperitoneal, they'll push, you know, the sac that has your organs to the side, and then you can actually go in, remove that bad disc, open up that disc space, and you put a cage with either screws or nails, lock that in, and then that actually gives you that indirect decompression of the nerve, and that should help give space for that nerve and then, you know, help with your symptoms. You subsequently can lock that, you know, you want to stabilize it by locking it up in the back, but that's probably one of my favorite surgeries. In the right patient.
Yeah. And then what are some things that are kind of new and exciting in the field of spine surgery, technology, innovation that you're excited about?
Ooh, so minimally invasive surgery is a big thing, right? You know, small incisions, big outcomes, all that type of stuff, right? That's big, right? Scoping the spine. How can we do these surgeries, which required a massive incision, with a smaller incision and still get the same results? You know, so that's big, right? Certain companies have instrumentation where instead of using a microscope, you can actually use a camera at the base of your portal to visualize the anatomy and then be able to, you know, decompress the spine. So stuff like that is very important. I do think there's certain things and things that I'm also excited about. You know, I do think a big incision is important depending on what you're doing, if you need to do it. So I'm not saying don't do a big incision. It's just, you know, it's dictated per case. But in deformity surgery, you're having, you know, there's something that we call proximal junctional kyphosis, which is where you do this big, big, big surgery for a person who needs it because they have a deformity and you want to correct that, right? But the problem is, in some cases, you know, at the top level of that construct, you know, they will, their deformity, they'll develop this, what we call kyphotic or a flexion deformity. Well, you have these modalities that can help, or at least down the pipeline. You know, we're still trying to figure out this problem. You have these modalities that can supplement that and decrease the chances of that occurring. So stuff like that gets me excited on both ends of the spectrum. Minimally invasive, but when you get to those bigger deformity cases, how to stop future problems from occurring.
Good, good. And then what would you say is kind of next for you? I mean, you went through medical school, you went through college, medical school, residency, fellowship. Now you're in practice. What's next for you? You know, I know that doctors are high achievers, kind of type A personalities, go-getters, most of them, I would say. You know, you get to this point, you've been working so hard, you know, 12, 14, 15 years to get to this point. What's next for you at this stage?
Great question. So for me, it's all about my purpose, right? I became, like, being a spine surgeon is great. I love it, right? It's my passion. My biggest thing, though, is my relationship with God. And, you know, I'm not perfect, but it's the growth there, right? And I believe I became a spine surgeon to help other individuals. So that is not just, that's the individuals around my community, because charity starts at home, right? So it starts off in my house. It starts off in San Antonio. Then it branches out to, you know, United States, and then far out from that. So medical mission work is where my heart lies, whether it be in North America, or whether it be in Africa, whether it be in Europe, whatever the case may be. So that is where I want to spread my quote-unquote tentacles to, so I can be a part of that and see where I can fit in to help. We actually have you know, by God's grace, we'll be able to do a medical mission work. And I know, you know, I talked to you about that before. It'll be in Nigeria, in Lagos, Nigeria, next year. So my goal is really to, you know, try to be as impactful. Stuff like that, that's my purpose. That's why I believe I was meant to be a spine surgeon, was to help. Because, you know, as you know, the number one complaint medically in the whole entire world is back pain. Now, we've been blessed to have all these modalities to help us, you know, treat it to a certain extent, but there's other places around the world that don't have people to, you know, address that. So I feel like that's my next step, is how can I get my hand in that? Obviously, building my practice, you know, continue to grow my family, however God wants that to look like. And then, you know, to also, you know, reach out to other individuals who want to go down my pathway. And how do you become a spine surgeon? How do you do this and that? So that's where I'm at.
Yeah, that's excellent. I look forward to that trip. I'll put some information regarding that in the show notes. But yeah, very, very inspiring story today of Dr. Ujonwe and kind of his path, kind of growing up, starting in Nebraska, all the way to San Antonio, Texas, as a fellowship-trained orthopedic spine surgeon. Where can people learn more about you? Where can they find you at?
So you can find me at thespinaldoc.com. My website, www.drjoelmd.com, is another place where you can find me. But yeah, those are Or you can find me on LinkedIn. LinkedIn is a place where I'm starting to really focus on in on social media. I'll also be pushing out an Instagram with more content in regards to my practice and spine surgery and then things of the spirit, you know, stuff like that. So that's where you can find me.
Awesome. Well, yeah, well, thank you for joining us on the WebMD podcast. So, you know, I have one final question with one word. I know you like two. One word. What do you think has led to your success to this point?
God.
Excellent. Dr. John Way, thank you for joining us on the WebMD podcast. You know, it's been a pleasure. Keep inspiring others that are coming behind us. You know, keep pushing along, and congrats on all your success.
Hey, appreciate you, bro.
Yep. All right. Thank you for joining us on this episode of the WebMD podcast. Today, we had a very inspiring guest, Dr. Joel Ejonway, who is a fellowship-trained orthopedic spine surgeon at the South Texas Spinal Clinic here in San Antonio, Texas, and who told us his story about his path to medicine, about how God and as well as his foundation in God has really helped him get to this point, and through those tough and challenging times in medical school and residency and fellowship and even to this day, and how important that is for everyone to have a foundation to just get to that next level and that next stage in life, as well as, you know, his time at University of Texas at San Antonio for his orthopedic surgery residency at Texas Back Institute, you know, what his favorite surgeries are and what his plans are for the future. But thank you guys for listening and joining in. Make sure you subscribe, and we'll see you on the next one.